This is Serial Killer, a true crime podcast. My name is Anne McElhenney, and I've worked all over the world as a journalist, covering everything from murders to baby trafficking. But I've never covered a story like the case of Philadelphia's Dr. Kermit Baron Gosnell. He is America's most prolific serial killer, but you've probably never heard of him. This podcast is the story of an almost 40-year killing spree by a medical doctor who carried out his crimes in plain sight. It is also the story of how those who were supposed to stop him looked the other way.
He's got medical waste in the basement and in the freezer, body parts that are decomposing, and she says it's from the abortions.
Right away, it was almost easy to believe that something wasn't right here. How could things be right?
The health department knew, the Pennsylvania Department of Health knew, and a lot of people knew, but just never did anything.
Some of the details are upsetting and not suitable for all ears, but this is a story you need to hear. Episode 2, we go inside the House of Horrors. In the last episode, we heard how Dr. Kermit Gosnell's crimes were exposed as part of a 2009 routine drugs investigation by undercover cops. Their informant told them he was writing hundreds of fraudulent prescriptions per night and making millions of dollars. Their informant also told them that Gosnell was operating a filthy clinic with unlicensed workers who may have been responsible for the tragic death of a woman called Carnamaya Monger. The case against Dr. Gosnell was quickly turning into a massive investigation involving the Philadelphia Police Department, the District Attorney's Office, the FBI, and the Drug Enforcement Administration. But none of them knew just how big the case was going to be. DEA investigators Steve Dougherty and Detective Jim Wood with the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office pick up the story. Jim Wood explains.
Basically, we were going to stop Gosnell. We didn't have an arrest warrant for him or anything, but we wanted to interview him. We also wanted to interview all the workers in his 3801 Lancaster location to find out what the stories are. Do they corroborate with what that informant said? So I obtained search warrants for Gosnell's truck, his office, his home, and the University of Pennsylvania, because that's where the medical records went for Carnamaya Monger. So I had four search warrants. Jason had a search warrant for the office. And that was pretty much it. We were ready to rock and roll.
Everybody brought their skills to the table. Sometimes in multi-agency things, it's whose case is this? Who's driving this bus? Who's running this show? But we just all like, okay, guys, you know what I think we ought to do next? I think we ought to go, we got to try to find so-and-so. All right, let's do that. It was incredibly wonderful people to work with, which was good because everything else about this case is nightmare horrible.
The investigating team needed to know what was going on inside the Women's Medical Society at 3801 Lancaster Avenue. They believed it was the center of a vast drug dealing operation and that Gosnell may have been responsible for the death of a patient. But they were still cognizant that this was an active medical center with patients coming in and out, often for lengthy abortion procedures.
So as far as preparing for the search warrant, I wanted to bring in somebody who I knew nothing about abortion clinics, about those laws. So I said, bring in somebody from the state who knows about the regulations, who's experienced in inspecting abortion clinics for violations.
And of course, going to an abortion clinic at this particular time, that it may be a lot of women there, Steve had the wherewithal to get Department of Health nurses involved. So they were the Department of Health nurses that were related to inspecting the clinics, though.
It was February 18, 2010. There was an air of excitement as the various law enforcement teams and regulators gathered at the FBI headquarters in Philadelphia. They were about to possibly take out one of Philadelphia's biggest drug dealers and maybe bring justice to the family of Carnamaya Monger. But Detective Jim Wood noticed that one of the Department of Health representatives seemed not to share their enthusiasm.
So there was kind of a little conflict there with one of the nurses. The other nurse was actually funny and jolly, and I took notice to the one and they refer to her to Nurse Ratched because that's exactly the way she was.
That health department nurse was Darlene Augustin. What Jim Wood and his colleagues didn't know at the time when they were preparing to raid the clinic was that she was keeping secrets from the law enforcement investigators. It later emerged Darlene Augustin knew lots about Carnamaya Monger's death, but had been ordered by her superiors not to assist the police in bringing Gosnell to justice. It was an extraordinary situation, as dozens of law enforcement officers were about to enter a building full of crime and criminals. One of the team was deliberately withholding information that could help direct their inquiries and searches, and perhaps even save them from injury. Augustine's withholding of potentially helpful and valuable information was kept secret until she and her superiors were forced to testify in front of a grand jury investigation into the Gosnell case. Grand jury proceedings are confidential, but the report of their findings is made public. This is an excerpt from the Gosnell grand jury, read by an actor.
State Department of Health inspectors refused to share information with law enforcement. Darlene Augustin testified that she was instructed by senior attorneys for the Pennsylvania Department of Health that she should not reveal anything about Carnamaya Monger's death to law enforcement when she accompanied them on the raid in February of 2010.
Investigators were later to discover that the Department of Health regulators and lawyers also held back extensive evidence of deaths and mutilations coming out of Dr. Gosnell's clinic. But they knew none of this as they prepared the raid on the Women's Medical Society. Almost 30 law enforcement and regulatory officers from various agencies were involved. There was a clear plan of action, who was to be interviewed and what evidence was to be gathered. None of this detailed planning prepared the team for what they would discover behind the doors of 3801 Lancaster Avenue. All would say it was unprecedented and shocked them to the core. Some say it changed their lives. The doors of Dr. Kermit Gosnell's Women's Medical Society hid crimes that should have been discovered but were ignored because of racism and political sensitivities. When they were uncovered, many would face serious criminal charges, including multiple murders, infanticide, and drug dealing. Many state regulators would lose their jobs. Several national media organizations and media personalities would apologize for not covering the story. The case would be referenced in the Supreme Court, and a possible presidential candidate would find that his policy of allowing Gosnell to operate unmolested was too damaging to brush off and abandoned any presidential aspirations he might have. But for the investigators, for now, they were just searching for evidence in a fairly routine drug case, with the suspicion that a woman had died under mysterious circumstances. On the evening of February 18, 2010, they discreetly surrounded the clinic. That's where I met up with Jim to find out more about what happened that night.
3801 Lancaster Avenue, I'll never forget it. And again, the building looks exactly the way it did when we showed up on February 18th, 2010 to serve the search warrant.
Well, we waited for Gosnell to show up. He worked at a clinic down in Delaware, and he showed up late. He came in late in the evenings to his business. That was a normal thing. So he shows up in his truck.
Surveillance followed him up from Delaware, and as he approached, we were all prepared to do the search warrants. We were just unsure where he was going to go.
Kermit Gosnell is now in prison. He says it took him a while to realize he was the target of the police presence.
I remember clearly coming into the intersection. I thought it was the usual problem with the bar across the street, which was scooters. They averaged 2 murders a year, and it was very common. I remember thinking, oh, it must have been another murder with scooters.
He pulled up adjacent to his office in a pickup truck that we had known about, and he was by himself. And the idea was when he pulled up, we were going to approach him, which we did.
When I pulled up and parked and they all ran towards me, that's when I knew that I was the reason for it.
So I approached from the rear of the truck, and Lieutenant McConnell accompanied me, and Gosnell got out of the driver's side after he parked his truck, and that's when I informed him what our purpose was for being there talking with him.
Well, at the time, I was amazed. I was astounded. I thought their questions were really off the wall, but I answered everything, and I felt it was ridiculous because I didn't feel that I had done anything wrong at all.
He was pretty nonchalant. I introduced myself, identified myself as Detective Wood from the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, and I said we had search warrants for his office and his house.
He was a little surprised, but he wasn't upset about it, that a whole team of law enforcement people were there, cars all over the place, were ready to go to a search warrant on his clinic.
This is the side door that I went in. He opened the door with a key, because there is a front entrance off of Lancaster Avenue. So agents and officers went there. Myself, Lieutenant McConnell, and a couple other detectives came with us through the side door. Now, you have to remember, this was a raid. So we secure everybody so no one can grab a gun and try to harm the officers that are in there.
We went in there, I'm going to guess, about 8 o'clock at night. And we wanted to try to interview everybody who was there.
And there were several civilians inside, there were also several workers inside. And the goal of a search warrant is to execute it properly and, most importantly, safely.
So we go walking into the clinic, and the first thing that hit us was the smell. A lot of times when you go into a doctor's office, there's like a medicinal smell. It smells like rubbing alcohol, medicine and all. This place stank.
And as soon as we walked in, you could immediately smell a horrid mixture of formaldehyde, urine, a strong chemical odor that was just rancid. It stuck in your nose. That smell hits you hard, and that's the way it smelled in there, like death.
It smelled like dirty cat litter. It smelled like urine. And I had been around a few unembalmed bodies in my life, and it smelled like unembalmed dead bodies. There's like a sickening sweet. It doesn't smell like anything else. John Taggart, who was a crime scene investigator on the site, John Taggart is a fine gentleman. He was a crime scene investigator, police officer. He had been to dozens, maybe hundreds of crime scenes. To him, the smell was unbearable. The stench was unbearable.
It was a surreal scene. The clinic workers were stopped in their routines as patients waiting and undergoing abortion procedures just watched what was happening. The law enforcement officers looked in every room and walked every corridor. Steve Doherty says the unsanitary conditions were evident throughout the entire building.
The examining rooms, you wouldn't take your dogs in to get their nails clipped there. The tables, the cloth was ripped and torn. There was protective padding that was under the metal frames for these women's legs. The protective padding was torn, and it was bare metal that these women were putting their legs on. The equipment was rusted. There was what appeared to be blood on the equipment. These chairs that women were sitting in outside waiting, there was a lot of crusted blood on them. In the clinic, there was this one long corridor, and along about a foot and a half up from the bottom of the baseboards was this dried brownish yellow dried liquid, which we believe was urine, because the drug seekers who went there would wait a long, long time, and the toilets were often clogged and not functioning, so we believe they just peed along the wall, at least some of them, and it didn't get wiped down too much.
At the time, investigators didn't know just what was blocking the toilets in the facility. Later, when they were to discover the source of the blockage, they would be horrified.
Along with everything that was going on, you had the one Nurse Ratched.
You'll remember that was the name Woody gave to Darlene Augustine. She was a regulator with the Pennsylvania Department of Health. The grand jury later found she and her superiors adopted an illegal hands-off approach that allowed Gosnell to operate unmolested for decades. They also found she was withholding information about Carnamiah Monger's death from the very law enforcement officers she was supposed to be assisting.
So I run into Nurse Ratched in the middle of doing the search warrant, and I'm looking around because the place is so dirty. There's blood on the floor. There's cats running around with cat litter in there. Just unbelievable. And I said to her, because again, I didn't know her from Adam. I didn't know what her backstory was. But I said, do you believe, I can't believe this place looks like this. And she said, you're just saying that because you're a police officer. I said, no, I'm saying it because I'm a human being.
Christine Wexler, an assistant district attorney and key player in the investigation, recalls her first impressions on visiting the clinic.
So right away, we knew something was wrong. The absolute squalor, the smell, the floors, the walls, the equipment was decrepit. The tables were, I mean, it looked like something out of a horror film. And to think that people were all of the time going in there, I mean, the lack of quality. I can't even describe to you how abhorrent a place it was. I made the mistake very early on of wearing regular work clothes to the facility. And I brought them home and they smelled so terribly that I threw them out because there was no way you could put them on. There was no way you couldn't relive, you know, the it was absolute squalor.
Gosnell claims he stayed in Philadelphia because he wanted to help the African-American community there. But as the investigators were to repeatedly discover, Gosnell had nothing but contempt for those he claimed he was helping. He said he knew what was best for them and that high standards would make his mostly minority patients uncomfortable.
And then, he being Gosnell, he said this in a letter. He wrote us a letter after the raid and before he was arrested. And he talked about the conditions there. He says, the population I serve, he used that term frequently, the population that I serve would be very uncomfortable in a sterile Mayo Clinic environment. This environment is more comfortable for the population that I serve. That means the filth was intentional.
Nowadays, Gosnell says he's proud of the standards in the clinic.
Oh, no, the place was compliant with the law. Now, they said that the conditions were not very good. However, I'm very proud of the facility and how it looked and how we completed that and how things were accomplished. In fact, I had a full-time person to do the cleanliness of the building. So there were European windows throughout, and there were terrariums. You may have somewhere noted that I was a horticultural ribbon winner at the Philadelphia Flower Show of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. But the hygiene of the place was not a problem.
When I challenged him again on this, he blamed any dirt or filth in his clinic on the hands-off approach by the state regulators.
Yes, well, that wasn't my fault that they didn't inspect me. I felt that I was on the cutting edge of the technology. And I was creating procedures and making decisions for patient welfare that were more than acceptable. And they had not inspected me for 18 years.
Gosnell's dates were just a little off. At the time of the raid, no regulator, inspector, or law enforcement personnel had set foot in his clinic for over 17 years. Even as conditions deteriorated, complaints were made, and Gosnell's patients were frequently turning up in emergency rooms, and even as the death count grew and grew. None of these highly paid regulators bothered to check out what was going on. 9 years before Karnamaya Monger's demise, Samika Shaw, a 22-year-old mother of two, had died after having an abortion at Gosnell's clinic. But neither death had prompted any health department regulators or law enforcement officer to visit 3801 Lancaster. The grand jury report was scathing about this completely hands-off approach, and they found that it was rooted in more than bureaucratic laziness. As the grand jury report noted, there had been inspections before 1993, even if they were inadequate. This is an actor reading the Gosnell case grand jury report.
After 1993, even that pro forma effort came to an end, not because of administrative ennui, although there had been plenty. Instead, the Pennsylvania Department of Health abruptly decided, for political reasons, to stop inspecting abortion clinics at all.
Abortion has been very politically contentious in America for over 50 years. Broadly speaking, Democrats favor a more liberal approach, and Republicans want restrictions, if not an outright ban on the procedure. Surprisingly, the grand jury found the hands-off approach, which led to a failure to inspect abortion clinics, was driven by Tom Ridge, the new Republican governor. Pennsylvania has, in recent decades, been a 50-50 state that has been won more and more by Democrats. In the 90s, the political consensus was that adopting liberal social policies was the only way a Republican could win. This is the then candidate Ridge, broadcasting his hands-off approach to abortion in the 1994 Pennsylvania gubernatorial debate.
I've always thought that the very difficult personal decision of having an abortion was the woman's decision, not government's. Certainly that decision in Pennsylvania is made within the provisions of the Pennsylvania law, which I have pledged to not only uphold, but to resist any efforts to change.
Yet the grand jury report found Governor Ridge and his officials did more than uphold the law. They weakened it. This is an actor reading their findings.
With the change of administration from Governor Casey to Governor Ridge, officials concluded that inspections would be, quote, putting a barrier up to women, unquote, seeking abortions. Better to leave clinics to do as they pleased, even though, as Gosnell proved, that meant both women and babies would pay.
The law enforcement officers on the night of the raid were oblivious to these political maneuverings that had effectively facilitated Gosnell's crimes. There was a lot going on. A large number of people attending the clinic, in addition to the 25 law enforcement officers conducting the raid. It was chaotic and noisy. But there was one person who the investigators were very keen to talk to, Dr. Kermit Gosnell.
So we allowed him to get his personal things out of his truck. And one of them was his bag. And he asked to bring his lunch, which was teriyaki salmon. And he also asked if he could bring his bag of clams. And this is kind of the first part of entering the Twilight Zone, right, is what I call it.
The clinic was full of patients, staff, drug dealers, health inspectors, and law enforcement officers. But the three lead investigators, Jim Wood of the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, Steve Dougherty of the DEA, and Jason Huff of the FBI, were very keen to isolate Dr. Gosnell for a formal interview. Amid the chaos, they asked to meet him privately in his office.
He puts his things down, and he goes and puts his clams away. And he comes back with two clams in his hand, and he asked if he could feed his turtles.
Fellas, if you don't mind, I want to feed my turtles first. He brings out a mesh bag of clams. I'll talk to you. Now, we weren't putting him under arrest at this point.
So in the front of his office, there was two big fish tanks, and they had turtles in them. And he proceeded to walk over to the fish tanks and, with his big hand, smashes the clams together.
Gosnell smashes some clams together, drops them in this aquarium of filthy, dirty, stagnant water with these turtles in there, these sea turtles.
Yeah, you can't make this stuff up. Something that I never expected. Like, if we have a search warrant for your office, doctor, you should drop everything you have and ask questions, right? That's what a normal person would do, I think. Like, but knowing who he is now, I can see why he acted that way.
Everything about this case was unusual and strange, even the building itself.
The building structurally was weird. It was three buildings that were side by side and then cobbled together. They opened up doorways. So it was a long, narrow building and a lot of tightly winding stairways, and you step from one building into the next, and the floor is not even with the other floor, so you're stepping up, you're stepping down. So it was a very confusing building.
In kind of a shape like a triangle almost. So when you walk through the building, it's like a maze in and of itself.
We had one of the employees try to give us a diagram of the building, but she was saying, well, this is here, and this is here, and this is here. It wasn't making any sense. But we realized she was describing it perfectly. It didn't make any sense because the building was all like it was like a nightmare thing.
And on top of it was absolutely bizarre. The waiting room where they would hold patients who were in the midst of procedures had lazy boys in it and a single bathroom. There was no privacy. There was no curtains. there was two small rooms, and then in the doctor's personal space, the massive amounts of files and stuff and plants and things that were overgrown and piled and piled. You knew that it had to have been there for ages.
The floors of the place were filthy. The counters were filthy. Anything that was like a white countertop was like black grime on there.
But to this day, Gosnell denies there was any problem with the cleanliness of the clinic.
All surfaces were hygienically sound, designed to decrease bacterial
This is a
flow.
Call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Huntingdon.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
We saw cat feces through the place. As we went through, they had a bunch of patients there. There were women sitting there delirious who were waiting for him to complete their abortions. They were in bad shape. And I said to the two nurses, I said, you're registered nurses. They said, what do you want us to do? I said, do what you normally do when you inspect an abortion clinic. So I don't know what these women did for a paycheck, but they hadn't been doing any inspections. You don't do something for 16 years, you're not really sure what you're supposed to do.
And it was kind of mayhem because there was 9 women waiting to get procedures, so we had to deal with them. There were other co-workers and other patients there. So luckily, we had formulated a plan to be able to, you know, settle all those people. It was mayhem. So all that stuff's going on with those people being stopped and talked to, and the people that we weren't really interested in were kind of cut loose, like patients that weren't in harm's way or whatever were let go. The other women, they called for rescue squads to have them taken to hospitals just to make, because they were given medications for their procedures. So a lot of them were taken away in rescue squads.
The medical welfare of the patients in the clinic had to be prioritized. But the arrival of the paramedics and the urgent evacuation of patients to hospital wasn't part of the plan. All over the building, individual staff members were isolated in separate rooms to facilitate interviews. This is normal practice in a raid like this. Anyone being interviewed should not have the opportunity to confer with colleagues. Meanwhile, the lead investigators were frustrated in their efforts to get time alone with Dr. Gosnell.
People are running all around, agents and cops, and just trying to organize things. And we're trying to get Gosnell in a room so Steve, Jason, and myself can interview him.
So he says, oh, come up to my office. I just have a couple of patients I want to take care of, and I have to water my plants. So he fed his turtles. Then he had patients who were waiting for him, and he wanted to water his plants. He had plants all through the place.
The other detectives were assigned to interview the workers there to find out what they could find out about Gosnell. And during the course of this, like I said, they were treating these women, and apparently one of the women was bleeding. So they decided to allow Gosnell finish the procedure on this woman while we were there. Jason and I are looking at each other like, this is nuts. Like, what if we end up arresting this guy and now he's allowed to do this procedure?
Then there followed a stand-up argument between those conducting the raid as to whether the suspect in the death of a woman during an abortion should be allowed to carry out an abortion in a clinic that clearly did not meet basic hygiene standards. Eventually, Jim Wood was overruled, and Gosnell was allowed to carry out the abortion. Christine Wexler explains.
They allowed him finish the procedure that had been interrupted when they went to execute the search warrant. And that the Department of Health knew that on site, none of the anesthesia monitoring equipment worked. They knew that it was filthy and not in an environment. They could have transferred that patient to a hospital so that she at least was in a clean environment. And they didn't do that. It was obvious they didn't care.
So, okay. He goes and does what he does and sidetracks us from the interview for a little while again. And he comes back and he's got these ripped, bloody gloves.
And that's when these veteran investigators saw something which almost made them physically ill.
And he asks if he could eat. So he whips out his teriyaki salmon and starts to eat with these bloody gloves.
He had just treated patients, kept his gloves on, with had holes and blood in them, and he's using that, eating with the chopsticks. And he dropped one of his chopsticks. And I told you, this place was full of cat urine, and there's what's called the five-second rule. If you drop something on the floor, you can pick it up in 5 seconds. That did not apply in Dr. Gosnell's office. You drop something, you don't pick it up. But he kept eating with the chopsticks.
The experienced law enforcement officers who were in the room interviewing Gosnell took detailed notes, as usual, of what they had just witnessed. And FBI agent Jason Huff later testified to the incident under oath. Yet Dr. Gosnell has a different memory.
That was where the federal agent misrepresented what I did. It was true that I was eating my salad and I had gloves on, yes, but they weren't the same gloves as the surgery, which he alluded to or intuited. And I ate them with my Japanese chopsticks. So it was ridiculous to say that I was being so unprofessional by eating lunch with my gloves on. I had my gloves on because I was working on my specimen for the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society flower show.
Just so you know, FBI agent Jason Huff has not eaten teriyaki salmon since.
Again, it's starting to add up in our minds that this guy's, I don't want to say he's nuts because he's not, he's diabolical. He knew he was making money with the abortions and the drug sales, so he's not so crazy, he doesn't know what he's doing. And some people ask me that often, like, would you say he's crazy? No, he's not. He's narcissistic, he's diabolical, and he's not crazy. And then there's probably some other things that he could be diagnosed as, but he definitely knew what he was doing.
But watching Kermit Gosnell eat food, wearing bloody gloves, was only the beginning of this very strange night. Jim and Steve were about to uncover some very weird and very gruesome evidence. Be warned, what they encountered in the next phase of this search is distressing.
The basement of the place was full of the red medical hazardous waste bags, big trash bags. We didn't open them, but the employees told us that was body parts.
And there's red biohazard bags on the basement floor, just piled up. And all that is the remnants of all the procedures he had done.
In addition to the plastic bags, the remains of aborted fetuses were kept in recycled juice cartons and plastic Dairymaid containers, and then placed in the freezer. Sam Galino, the Philadelphia medical examiner, later gave evidence about the containers. This is an actor reading a transcript of his evidence.
There was a great variety of the types of containers. Some of them were, in one case, a distilled water jug where the top had been cut off of it. Others were drink containers, like I think one was a cherry limeade container that had been used. There was others that I recognized. It was a container that you would have either cat or dog food in because I had actually used that brand of cat food with my cat. So I knew what the container was by its very distinctive shape. And in most of the cases, the tops had been cut off so that the opening was larger.
Dr. Gosnell does not deny there was an accumulation of what he called medical waste in the basement of his facility, and he sought to offer an explanation.
Part of the allegations of things that were not well thought of had to do with how we were able to manage the waste removal. The fetal products were normally sent for hazardous waste, and we did that routinely, and we used containers, which was criticized a great deal, but the policy of the hazardous waste unit was that they would not accept any boxes or containers which had blood present. And so it was important to put the products in a sealed container so that it would be able to be picked up by hazardous waste. Do you understand that?
But many of the containers were not sealed. And he goes on to explain, or attempt to explain, that he was in dispute with his medical waste removal company. He hadn't paid them, and they wouldn't collect from him. He maintains he was refusing to pay the waste management companies in order to keep his costs down.
Every time I would use something that cost money, it would increase my price. And so I used containers that were accessible or that were recyclables rather than purchase a particular size of professional containers. And that's not an inexpensive item. And so I never thought that was a problem.
There was not just biological material in the containers. They contained bodies, intact bodies, resulting from Dr. Gosnell's legal and late-term and possibly illegal abortions. Investigators didn't realize it then, but these bodies were to be crucial evidence in a case that expanded far beyond what any of them expected.
And then we go to the freezer. We call the medical examiner office to have a medical examiner officer come out, which to do autopsies. So he comes out, writes up a slip of what he took, and I think it was 27 bodies, and that's what the label said. But when they thawed them out, it ended up being 47 bodies.
Believe it or not, the frozen bodies in juice cartons and dog and cat food containers was not the weirdest or most gruesome evidence found in Gosnell's clinic. The investigators saw something which showed them this was no ordinary case of drug dealing and medical malpractice.
So as I walked down the hall, past two of the three operating rooms, I went down to an area that contained a lot of products that are used for cleaning up after the procedures. And in a cabinet that was to the left, I opened it up, and that's when I saw the plastic container with the green lids. And then I saw it was feet.
There on the shelves were a series of jars containing babies' feet preserved in liquid. They were meticulously labeled in Gosnell's neat handwriting.
I didn't know if it's okay. I've never been in an abortion facility before, so I didn't know. I mean, I didn't think it was right. Common sense. Why would you need a whole foot, whole human foot, and not just one? There were several in these little jars.
Yeah, I saw the baby's feet. There were five or six jars in this cabinet. They look like urine sample jars with clear liquid in them and baby's feet. One of the employees told us that at one point he had about 50 of these.
You asked about why I cut off the feet and kept them. Well, it's a kind of a longish story and also a short story. Above a certain number of weeks, one was required to send the entire specimen or have a pathologist evaluate and give examinations of what they were looking for was viability. A pathologist came to me, and he agreed that the laws about sending the entire product of a second trimester pregnancy for evaluation was not appropriate or necessary or in keeping with things. And so he offered me a price, and for $50, he would provide all of the information that the law specified had to be sent off. And when I sent him specimens of people where the foot was presented, and he was able to write the report, including the amount of the amniotic fluid and the various sizes of the fetal specimen. But he was able to generate the necessary paperwork, as I remember, for $50 to fulfill the state requirement.
Gosnell's explanation is nonsense. He never filed any of the appropriate paperwork required by the Department of Health, and they never bothered asking for it. Also, his story keeps shifting. Now he claims it was for a state-mandated paperwork. But in his original interviews with the investigation team, Dr. Gosnell said he kept the feet as samples in case they were later required for DNA analysis.
I got a little complacent and overloaded when I got behind and realized I was going to have to be evaluated. I keep very excellent records of all the procedures and knew which procedures needed a documentation by fetal feet, and that was the discipline. And it was something that I generally did myself.
We didn't know what purpose, why you would keep feet of infants or fetuses in jars, in cabinets. It didn't make any sense. I mean, we found, and I think it's described really clearly in the grand jury report, we found the feet of a fetus that the procedure had taken place years before, but it didn't make any sense. And I mean, I remember calling, someone gave me the contact of a doctor in California that specialized in fetishes. And that doctor was like, what? It doesn't even make any sense.
Gosnell does appear to have a strange fascination with feet. Investigators who had listened to recordings of his prison phone calls say he talks incessantly about his feet. I certainly experienced his boasting about his large feet when I visited him in 2014. It was almost the first thing he told me as he sat down in the visiting room and started complaining about the poor choices of footwear available for his extra large feet. Bizarrely, he would also talk about the subject while he told me about his visit to Auschwitz concentration camp in the late 70s. He said he found the death camp, where over 1 million men, women and children died, fascinating. And he was particularly fascinated by the monument to the children who had died. It was, he explained in detail, a wooden structure consisting of row after row of tiny shoes that were taken from the dead children. And he would often talk about feet during our many phone calls.
Every time I saw a case, the foot length was a little bit more than I expected it to be based on my estimated gestational size. I found it was a large black male. And my own foot size is large. I have a large foot. I have the same shoe size as Michael Jordan and LeBron.
And he tried to make it look like it was some kind of genetic connection, you know, in talking to other abortion doctors. That didn't make sense to them either. So again, I refer to that as his collection of what a serial killer would collect from their victims.
The homicide detective, Jack McDermott, he says these are trophies. Gosnell said in court that these were for like tissue samples for genetic testing or something, but the other doctor said, no, you need a little piece of tissue. You don't take a whole foot. These were not that tiny. These are like baby feet. Severed and put up on display.
We just ended up confiscating a bunch of medicines, the Demerol I took, the fentanyl, like I said, everything related to Karnamaya Mongar's death. But at the time, like I said, we still didn't know what we had as far as additional crimes besides the death of Karnamaya Mongar and the drug stuff.
As I was later to find, Dr. Gosnell liked to talk about himself and about his life and his work. That narcissism was useful for the investigating team.
When we interviewed Dr. Gosnell, he told us, now I'm a DEA guy, there's a Philadelphia detective, there's an FBI agent, and he is casually telling us that, what were his words? That he was prescribing OxyContin for the emotional well-being of his patients. Not for pain, not for medical, for emotional well-being. He knew that other doctors don't do this. He told us, I realize other doctors don't write oxycodone for emotional well-being, but I do. The man just got more and more bizarre.
In the other rooms, staff members were talking long and in detail. They told investigators how Gosnell was faking ultrasound scans. In Pennsylvania, abortion is legal up to 6 months. But staff said he would manipulate the ultrasound wand to make the fetus appear smaller than it actually was. This would allow him to perform later, illegal abortions of 7 and 8 months, even up to full term.
As I said, we interviewed all the employees that we could find. And between interviewing people, they decided to cooperate with us.
And the others are interviewing the other workers. And we're getting information from the other people that are being interviewed. So we're... That was good for us because you have several others that were saying, oh yeah, doc does this, doc does that. And we also found out that he would, on some of the patients, adjust the ultrasound wand. And that was good information because there's no reason to do that unless you know that what you're doing is wrong. So then I started asking him about the ultrasounds. Why would you tell your workers how to adjust the ultrasound wand if they were within the 24 weeks anyway? And that was one question he wasn't ready for, because there was no, he couldn't answer that, because it was the first time. What happened, he actually put his head down and his color changed from his face when I, because he knew he couldn't answer it. The only time I ever saw him drop his composure, but he knew that his coworkers were talking. That's what bothered him too. So that's when we knew, like, we got him. And it was because of the help of the other workers there that basically gave him up.
Then Gosnell's love of talking led him to another admission of wrongdoing.
You don't get anything better in an investigation than an actual admission from the subject, you know, and it kind of fast forwards your whole case. And he was talkative. He talked about everything. And like I said, that was the other question that I had asked him. I said, Doc, the babies in the freezer, how many were past the 24 weeks, if you had to get a percentage? And he actually said, another admission, 10 to 20%. He said, if we checked those babies in the freezer, he wouldn't be surprised if 10 or 20% of them were past 24 weeks. But again, it was another admission to the same thing he admitted with the drug stuff. He just was a talkative guy and thought he could explain things.
No, I specifically remember that question, and I was misquoted. And that was another area where the prosecution did not present the truth. I said that no more than 10% would be found over the limit was my estimation. They asked me what my estimation was.
As Jim said, Gosnell was not the only one who was speaking to investigators. His staff were talking and talking. Law enforcement was starting to realize the depth of Gosnell's depravity and that they may be investigating a serial killer.
So finally, they started telling us about the abortion stuff.
As we have heard previously, abortion is legal in Pennsylvania up to 24 weeks. That's 6 months into a pregnancy. But the staff were telling investigators that Gosnell was doing abortions much later, very much later. And they were telling the investigators about behavior that would propel Gosnell and themselves into the ranks of America's, and perhaps the world's, most prolific serial killers. Gosnell's staff started to talk about Gosnell's preferred method of late-term abortion, and it chilled these veteran investigators. A normal legal second trimester abortion in Pennsylvania involves a pregnancy that is less than 6 months and sees the doctor injecting the fetus in utero with a poison to ensure death. Then the baby is surgically dismembered in utero to ensure easy extraction. It's a brutal procedure, but it's also legal.
You know, the higher the age, the more difficult it is to remove a fetus at a gestational age beyond 20 weeks even. And what we began to understand was that medical providers, they do those procedures in the hospital for lots of reasons, not the least of which is the need to appropriately anesthetize someone, strictly monitor them, and have lots by way of resources available to them. It's really messy. You need a lot by way of good staff and good people and good things and instruments around you. And I had been at the place. He didn't have any of that.
Gosnell could not meet any of these requirements, so he decided on an abortion method that was quicker, simpler, and cheaper, and probably murder. Staff members told investigators that he would pretend to give the woman the injection to kill the fetus, but he didn't want to spend the money on the drug, so it would be a fake injection. He would then have unqualified staff sedate the women and give them a lot of Cytotec, a drug which would induce labor, which would cause the baby to be born, very often alive. Gosnell would describe this as precipitation. This is how the grand jury that was convened into Gosnell's criminality described his methods and why he did them.
Latasha Lewis said Gosnell told her that he preferred it when women precipitated because it made his job easier. A surgical procedure to remove fetuses, Lewis explained, could take half an hour. In addition, by avoiding surgical abortions, Gosnell was less likely to perforate the women's uteruses with surgical instruments, something he had done and been sued for many times. If fetuses had not precipitated, Gosnell would often have his staff physically push them out of their mothers by pressing on the mother's abdomens.
So the workers there, they start talking about killing babies. And in telling us that, just Jason, I, and Steve, we're getting information from Linda Williams, and you have Sherry West and several others telling us about how he would do the procedures where the babies would be delivered alive, and he would cut their necks.
We probably interviewed three or four people who testified to these snippings and killings.
Investigators heard how a live baby would be born, often over 24 weeks, sometimes 7, 8 months gestation, or even full term. And then they would be killed. Gosnell would cut their spinal cord with scissors. He called this snipping. If the babies were born when he was not there, he had trained some members of the staff to do the snipping instead. The grand jury report described why Gosnell did what he did.
Gosnell and his employees performed abortions long after the legal limit. The doctor's unorthodox methods virtually mandated the premature delivery of live babies. He killed live, viable, moving, breathing, crying babies. He killed them by cutting their spinal cords after their mothers had delivered them, after receiving excessive amounts of medication designed to induce active labor. This report documents multiple murders of viable babies. The evidence makes a compelling case that many others were also murdered. The pain, suffering, and death that he and his employees perpetrated were not the result of accidentally botched procedures. It was Gosnell's standard business practice to slay viable babies. Gosnell's procedure was not only grossly out of compliance with accepted medical standards, it was ghoulish, dangerous, and criminal.
To realize that when these women were saying, and sometimes they would come out and they would move or cry or breathe, and then he would snip the necks, you know, then we realized we had just something on our hands that was like so beyond what anybody could have imagined.
We got out of there. The sun was coming up the following Friday morning. I went home. I went right to the washing machine. The stench was clinging to me. And I took all my clothes. There was a towel there. I put a towel around me, put my sneakers, my socks, everything, my socks, my underwear went in there. And I took a long shower to get the stench off me.
We ended up leaving that night, but I knew, obviously, the investigation was going to continue because of the additional information that we received.
What the investigators discovered that night of the raid on the Women's Medical Society clinic only made them realize they needed to go back and dig deeper. There were significant questions about the staff and their qualifications, and what evidence was in the medical files. And what about Dr. Gosnell himself and his weird medical practices? A search warrant for his house was another priority. Investigators also needed to find out more about the death of Karnemiah Monger. And then the mass murder of babies born alive. The investigators needed to secure solid evidence to support the allegations and allow them to press charges against America's biggest serial killer. In the next episode, Digging Deeper. Serial Killer, a true crime podcast, is a production of the Unreported Story Society. To learn more about the investigation into Dr. Kermit Gosnell, you could read my book, Gosnell, The Untold Story of America's Most Prolific Serial Killer. It's co-written with Phelan McAleer. I'm Anne McElhenney. This podcast was produced by Phelan McAleer. Magda Segeda was executive producer, and it was edited by Peter Kelly. To get the next episode of Serial Killer, please subscribe for free on your podcast app and sign up for our email list at serialkillerpod.com.